welcome, folks, to episode 3,458 of the Survival Podcast, starting just a little bit later than planned today. We were supposed to be live at noon, and my guest, who was going to talk to us about off-grid living, is truly living off-grid, and it made the connection unacceptable for doing a live stream podcast. We will have him find a place where he can get a more stable connection and a better environment, and we'll bring him back on. I want to point out right now as we do the intro to this show, I'm not picking on my guest or anything, and nothing I'm about to say should construe that. Things happen, and it's part of being a podcaster, and it's part of being a podcaster that's willing to do most of their podcasts in a live stream. If you notice, there's not a lot of that out there, really. There's a lot of live streams, but dedicated podcasts, only a few of us really do this consistently over time. I give a lot of interviews with people, and they're like, yeah, we're going to use Zoom or StreamYard or whatever and do a live stream. I'm like, okay, great. Like, tell me the destinations or whatever so I can promote it for you while we're live. And then they're always like, well, we're not going to actually be live. I'm going to record it and then publish it in advance. I just gave one to somebody about 2.5 weeks ago, and the podcast isn't even live yet. Logan, what's up, bro? Let me know when that goes live, and I'll push it for you. So when you take that step, and this is one of the reasons that other podcasters don't, not only do you not get the chance to edit, you can't hide your screw-ups and your mess-ups and everything, you also are subject to the whims of things like storms and bad connections and stuff. But to me, I would rather do that. I would rather do that since I started doing it about 2 years ago. Because the real-time feedback from the audience while you're going tells you when you're blowing it, when you're missing it, etc., and I think it's worth the extra effort. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, I was forced to come up with something and be ready to go in about, 30 to 45 minutes from idea to execution to promotion to ready to go. And I thought, well, let's talk today about something that I've been building into my newest course, which is on soil secrets and cover cropping for the backyard. And we're going to talk about biology over chemistry today to restore our planet. And even though the coursework I'm doing is really going to be generated toward the average person that wants a very fertile, productive garden, homestead, maybe a market garden, couple acres in size. We're going to come at this today from a standpoint of you can do all of this yourself on that small plot of land, but everything we're going to talk about today is doable and should be done at the mass agricultural scale. And if we're going to fix our planet, that's where it needs to be done. It is actually starting to move in that direction. That is, it's very hopeful to me to see what's going on with probably the most benevolent government bureaucracy on the planet, which is the USDA, not them, but the USDA's sub-organization known as NRCS. Some of the work NRCS is doing, and we're really not going to talk about them today, but it's very, very encouraging. More and more farmers are starting to realize that just continuously dumping more of the cidal cocktails on the land and adding more and more inputs and more fertilizer just isn't working. And the ROI keeps going down. The amount you have to buy and put in keeps going up. The amount you get out continues to go down. And the price the farmer's getting, despite what we're paying in the grocery stores, is often also going down or flat. No one makes less money in the food business than the people that actually produce the food, which is completely backwards. And we're going to talk about how we change that today and end up with a better planet, a better world. If you are a big believer in the global warming world and it's, we've got to fix climate change, it'll do that too. If you're right and if you're wrong, it'll fix things anyway. That's the angle we're going to come at today. Instead of disagreeing, let's agree on what we can do that actually works. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Joel Riles with K9 Academy. Joel's a member of the Expert Council, though a little bit absent the last couple weeks. I am giving him a pass. They are moving their entire operation without planning, by the way, from Florida to Ohio. I'm like, you just take all the time you need, bro, with getting me your answers. But, man, he's been a great servant to this community for a very long time, so I was happy to bring him on with this agreement for K9 Academy, which I actually helped him build the flow and the marketing and the concept of. And it's a very simple thing, actually. And that is that if you want your dog to do anything really well, it all starts with conditioning the dog to have the response that you want versus the one that you don't want. And that all starts with basic core obedience. And if you want to make sure you have a great dog, you want those core obedience things. And that's the Canine Academy Basics program. Then there's other programs that you can pick through once you're done with that. But I'm telling you, man, core obedience. There's so many people, I want my dog to be a protection dog. I want my dog to be a hunting dog. I want it to be a livestock guardian dog. I want blah, 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 blah. In the end, all of it begins with core obedience. Once we have the core obedience, then it's just a matter of getting the dog to understand what we want. Dogs actually, because of our long-term relationship with them, the goal of the dog is to please its master in different ways. You know, some are more that way than a golden retriever is much more concerned with pleasing you than a Siberian Husky. But with that's really more intrinsic characteristics. When it comes right down to it, all dogs want to please their masters. So once they understand you and once we have core obedience, we can get that dog to do anything. So if you want it to be a protection dog, you start with core obedience. You want it to be a hunting dog, core obedience. You want it to be just a great homestead dog, core obedience. You see where I'm going here? So check out canineacademy.us. But Joel's one of the few people I have a relationship with where all of our interaction really is about affiliates. So if you would, I'd appreciate it if you would use the link on the survivalpodcast.com from his banner or in the show notes or the video notes below when you click on over there so I get credit for sending him your business. Next up today, the Wealth Steading Podcast with John Pugliano. We're going to talk about soil today. We're going to talk about organic solutions, which really we should call biological solutions in my opinion, and growing lots of food. And John Pugliano believes in growing lots of wealth. And the Wealth Steading Podcast will help you learn how to grow your wealth like you grow your garden. You can listen to independent money manager John Pugliano as he describes the stock market conditions and the rationale behind his trades. He has nearly 40 years of investing experience. He's an entrepreneur, an author, an inventor, and the founder of Investable Wealth LLC, where he functions as an investment manager as well. Before John took a dime of somebody else's money as an investment manager, he made himself a liquid millionaire through investing. And he's a guy that believes in doing before you sell a thing, and I really respect that. He's also been a member of our expert council and this community all the way since 2010. 14 years we've been working with John. I don't see him going anywhere anytime soon. Check him out at thewealthsteadingpodcast.com. He's a guy you know that you can trust. I'll always be honest with you. All right, with that, let's start digging into this. And I want to talk a little bit about the mindset I'm coming at with this today. And it's the fact that we have actually abandoned what worked for humans for so long, like 10,000 years, maybe longer. That's the generally agreed upon academic number. And I actually think that humans have been cultivating plants and building civilizations in different forms that maybe we just don't recognize the remains thereof for longer than that. But I'll take 10,000 years of doing things in a way that was mostly, not always, but mostly with nature, versus 100 years of a way that we can't possibly live without now. And so that's where I'm coming from with it. But how do we turn away from that? If biological solutions work so good, and you can kind of hear the contrarian to this line of thinking that we're going to talk about today going, hey, if you're so right, if biology was able to do everything that we need, if we didn't need to have, you know, all of these sprays and biocides and fertilizers and all, then why do we do it in the first place, Jack? Because your story, Jack, and so many others like Gabe Brown and Ray Aguiletas, all we can not only get rid of all that, but we can produce as much or more per the acre with these natural solutions than these chemical science-based solutions. And boy, is that an abused word today, science. And I'm not even talking about the concept of things that aren't science being called science. I'm talking about the fact that since something's science, it must be right in all instances where it's not. Because we're talking about what today? Biology versus chemistry. Both of them are science. Both of them are incredibly valid. Both of them are very important to humanity and life as a whole. Both of them do apply to agriculture and horticulture, even the way we're going to talk about it today. I mean, the way I would explain it is biology is how we grow, and chemistry explains the how. So I'm not talking about throwing chemistry as a discipline away. I'm saying that is the solution a chemistry solution or a biological solution? Chemistry, you know, organic chemistry is the chemistry of organics or the chemistry of life or biochemistry, right? Like, so it's not like chemistry bad, biology good. It's that misapplied, any tool can be bad. I love guns. You guys know that. I'm as pro-gun ownership as a human being can possibly be. I think we should go back to the days where you could order a gun from the Sears catalog and it would show up on your front door. Does that mean guns can't be used improperly? I mean, I think the state uses the guns and the force behind them improperly all the time. I think criminals use guns improperly all the time. It's part of why I'm so much of a belief that we should have that tool as a counterbalance, right? But it doesn't mean that the gun is bad or good. The gun itself is inert. It's the application thereof. So chemistry isn't bad, but chemistry can be used for some really bad things. To make an example of this, if you understand the basic chemistry and the biology of humans and carbon dioxide, right? You can use something like dry ice to kill somebody with a hole in the wall and a straw and maybe a cooler so you can push the CO2 into another room, and while a person sleeps, they can die in their sleep because of chemistry. That would be bad use of chemistry. The other side of it is try to run your car if nobody had figured out chemistry, like how to refine oil into gasoline and put it into an internal combustion engine. So neither one of these is bad. They're just different. So how did we get to this point where we turned away from biological solutions, which are abundant and everywhere, to chemical solutions that are controlled by select individuals and sold to us as a solution to biological problems? How do we get there? Well, it really all goes back to Thomas Malthus. And many of you have probably heard the term Malthusian philosophy, right? Or Malthusianism. And many people that have heard it that even sort of kind of know what it is don't really know where it's from or how we ended up with it, or how long it's been around. They just know it's bad, right? Like, if I say Malthusian, you probably think, oh, not good, right? Well, this started in 1798. Thomas Malthus published, and it was anonymous, the first edition of it, an essay on the principles of populations as it affects the future improvement of society. And the basic thesis was as follows. Populations always outstrip the ability of systems of production to support them. In other words, we're all going to starve, right? Humanity's going to starve. Oh, and yes, for those on the video, it's exactly what it looks like. That's even the name brand, and if you're in the audio, you don't get to know. It's just one of those days. We're going to have fun. All right, so that was Malthus's thesis. And this got accepted by a lot of governments and people in charge. And as soon as that happens, then industry seeking to serve what governments want because they make lots of money doing it, grabbed onto it. And then son of a gun, it kind of like the solution kind of worked. And we'll get to that in a second. But here's the problem with Malthusian philosophy. While Thomas Malthus is the person it was named after, and he really codified it into the lexicon and accepted philosophical and scientific circles, he's not the originator, really. This is something that people believed for a very, very long time and still believe today. We still live under a Malthusian philosophy. We can't do this any other way except to use science fiction technology, otherwise everybody will starve. But here's the problem. All these chemical solutions are basically post-World War I solutions. We didn't really have most of the solutions today that we absolutely need to survive until after World War I. And all the way up to World War I, Malthus and his, you know, his philosophy and his followers were ringing the bell. And it makes me think of a very famous GIF that people use in memes sometimes. And it's Benjamin Sisko from the Deep Space Nine Star Trek world. And Benjamin's standing there, and he says, "That's all very moving, except for one small problem. It never happened." That's the problem of Malthusian philosophy. We are still working on a premise of a theory that has never even happened, or has never even got close to happening. Now again, long before Malthus put this down on paper, plenty of people were thinking this way. Humans expand their population, they can only produce so much food from the land, eventually there has to be a crash and everybody has to die. This has never happened. The global demand for food has never outstripped the production capacity of food. Now, I'm not saying there's never been famines. I'm not saying that humans have never failed to adapt to things like droughts and climatic events and what have you. But the capacity of production is way beyond what's necessary for survival of the human species or even for humans to survive. That may be hard to believe, but it's only hard to believe because they've told you it so many times. It's been pounded into your little brain since probably about kindergarten age, one way or another, with the programming that is education and the media. We'll starve without it. Except again, it's never happened. We've destroyed and denuded areas and had to move on. And if we used more biology with current scientific understanding, we could stop doing that. But we absolutely can feed the planet. We're doing it. The places where people are starving today, it's because the land is degraded, which can be restored. But mostly it's political issues. It's warfare that's keeping people from eating. It's ingrained poverty. It's not that the food isn't there. It's that they don't have the money to pay for the food that's not being grown where they are. The Malthusian cult is a cult based on, if not a lie, at least a complete failure for it ever to even be close to being realized. So let's go from there. I know that may be hard for some to understand. So how do we end up there? Then, well, chemical solutions do work for a time. And in the beginning, they were extremely cheap. The way we ended up with this is after World War I, there was a lot of mobilization of industry, and then this ramped up even more in World War II, but World War I ramped up the first big production of heavy mechanized equipment and chemicals that were used to kill people. It didn't take chemists long to figure out, well, you know, like spraying mustard gas out into a field and killing the whole town downrange from it, probably not a good idea, but if we modify these chemicals, right? If we modify these chemicals and we reduce their potency, well, they'll kill an aphid, but not a human. Well, that can't be bad, so let's do that. And then people figured out if we patent it, we can make money on it. And then they figured, well, we could take this chemical and slightly modify it, and it will kill a plant. And so we can use it as an herbicide and a pesticide. And then at the same time, like this goes back pre-World War I, but it still got ramped up heavily after. Chemists figured out that if we do things like pour acid on certain rocks, we can extract fertilizers from them. And all of a sudden, we're making all of these fertilizers and chemical sides, and we're doing it very inexpensively because as it's a growing market that hasn't taken over everything yet, and we're using byproducts to make it. We're using like byproducts of the chemical industry, byproducts of the petroleum industry, which is where most of our NPK fertilizer still comes from. All of a sudden, this stuff was dirt cheap. And the farmers were like, well, does it work? And, I mean, this is the sales tactic that was used. They would go out and give a guy a bag of ammonium nitrate and say, go dump it somewhere in your field in a pattern and go back and look at it in a month. You could write your name in the field or something, and it would all grow faster than ever. It worked. So it worked, and it was cheap. And the government was subsidizing it, so it was even cheaper. And your friend was doing it, and your other friend was doing it, and here you are with your oxen, you know, plowing a field, and you're wondering, how do I keep up? I've got to do this. It's like, you know, you put steroids in professional sports, sanctioned and open and allowed. How long is it going to be before everybody's doing it? Because they have to keep up. And it works for a time until what? Your heart explodes. Or your nads shrink. Or you go into psychological rage. What happens when we keep dumping chemicals into a system that aren't natural for the system? Eventually we get systemic dysfunction, which is where we're at today. on a huge level, a level that without the funding, the marketing, the push, and the control by people making billions, if not trillions of dollars off this, could never have continued on. Farmers know this is wrong, but they don't know another way. That's how we ended up where we are today, right? Now, the other thing is, in all of this, humans have placed incredible faith in three places that faith does not belong. We have put our faith in the scientific, academic, and state-based authorities. We have decided if they say something's true, it must be true. And if it's not, if you say it's not true, you're anti-science, right? You're anti-science. Even if you're really objecting to what the state says or the media says, the label is you're anti-science. Even when you're using science to explain why this other so-called science is wrong, you're what? You're anti-science. So that faith has harmed us greatly. Because any debate is immediately shut down with, but the government says, but the media says, but experts say, comma experts say, right? We just shut that and quash that down. So that was able to let this problem manifest itself and metastasize into the cancer that it is today, that has destroyed life in the soil on most farms, including many organic farms. The soil has no life. Your soil, if it has an organic matter content of like a 0.5% or less, it can't have life in it, because if it had life in it, it would have more carbon in it. Tell me what life we know of on this planet that's not based in carbon. So if half of your soil is organic matter, 0.5% is organic matter, then only 0.5% even has the potential to be life, and some of it's dead organic matter. You understand how this, there's no way that this makes any sense, but yet we've done it. And it's because we've given an ungodly amount of authority and credit and faith to people who do not deserve it, because they have failed to prove anything that they've claimed other than short term this works. Think of how many things that you can think of in your life that you could use to cheat that have short term gain but long term ill consequences. Now, the good thing is when you do that, you're the one that generally suffers, or a few people around you, unfortunately. But when you do something stupid for short-term gain, you primarily hurt yourself. But what if you convince the people that grow the food for the billions of people around the world that do not grow their own food to do something for short-term gain that has negative long-term consequences, and you do it across trillions of acres of land? You disrupt not just the food supply for people, but you disrupt the ecological and biological processes of the whole damn planet. You want disruption of climate. How about disrupt the atmosphere? How about fuck up the carbon cycle? Don't tell me about the carbon coming out of a tailpipe when you've destroyed the carbon cycle that moves the carbon in a cycle that actually needs to be completed, that puts carbon out of the air into the soil, and you're telling me about this carbon over here. You've disrupted the cycle. You've disrupted the water cycle. You've disrupted the breeding cycle of countless organisms that are keystone to their ecosystems, even though they're tiny little things, maybe some you can't even see. We have become arrogant. We think because we're important that all things that are important are big. Well, there's two ways to be big. There's big as an individual, and there's big as a collective. There's a hell of a lot more arthropod biomass on this planet than there is human biomass. Megafauna make up about 14% of the biomass on the planet in the animal kingdom. In the animal kingdom. Megafauna is us, it's deer, it's elephants, etc. We are small. That's because that's just the animal kingdom. You start throwing in like the fungi, and you start throwing in the plant material, we are nothing. We are nothing. And we've disrupted all of these species and their natural cycles. So, the last piece to this, how we got here, the monetary gain became unimaginable of what could be done if you harnessed and systemized and created recipes and formulas and patents. Some of the most valuable corporations in the world today, especially if you take out the financial sectors, you take the banks out who print money. So obviously they're going to be the biggest. But it's two places today, really, that are the biggest, right? It's actually three. It's the energy business. That's everything. That's alternative. It's fossil fuels. It's all of it. It's the agricultural industry, right? Those are two of your biggest, and it's technology. Those are like your three biggest sectors. And the reason technology is so big is the cost of production is so low. And it's you can disseminate it as software with no physical product. So that kind of goes in its own little category. But when we look at agriculture, it's because everybody has to eat and all food comes from some form of what we collectively call agriculture. Even if it's like ranching or something like that. So it's something that everybody has to have. That's going to make it massive. Now, if you can take the government and convince the government, oh, this has to be done the way we say, or everybody will starve. And we know what happens when populations start starving to government officials and bureaucrats. They kill them. This is historically factual. When a civilization begins to decline due to starvation, they turn on the state and they kill them. So it's a pretty easy deal for the Conagras and Bears and formerly Monsanto, now Bears of the world, and the John Deere's of the world, all the chemical and mechanical engineering companies to go to the government and say, we need to templatize this. We need to do the whole go big or go home like T. Boone Pickens in the 70s. We need to finance this. We need to subsidize this, and this needs to be controlled, or I'm going to tell you what, the peasants are going to get the pitchforks and the shovels and the torches, and they're going to come and they're going to get you. And once you have that done, you have everything. You have total control. Because the only thing left to put a check, because the media is done at that point, right? The media is going to go along with what the state says and what the money tells them to say. That's why you have a kabillion freaking pharmaceutical commercials on TV all the time, as an aside there, right? So that's going to be done. So the last thing you have isn't the farmer. The farmer is going to do what the farmer is incentivized to do. No, the only thing you have left is the academics, the real researchers to say, wait a minute, this doesn't work. So once you have that much money coming in, you just go buy academia out. You know, you go in and you buy the programs, you buy a building for a college, you write the textbooks, you hire their graduates so they can say our graduates get hired, and you have an iron grip. And that's where we are, and that's how we got there. And I put so much into explaining that, because if you don't understand how we got there, then when I give you the way out, you think, well, if that worked, why wouldn't we just do it? Because what we're going to talk about doing next doesn't make these companies lots of money. Some of them it still would. John Deere could still make a lot of money in this model. But Monsanto, Bayer, Conagra, all the genetic stack sequence seed companies, and then the government's subsidy program, which is part of their control mechanism, all that shit just goes away. Right? And then there's all sorts of pieces and parts that bolt into this that have become part of this parasitic economy that also suffer. So there's a lot of money resistance. Plus, now you got to also turn around and get the professor who's taught in, you know, Texas A&M University or whatever, in agricultural classes for 30 years. Kids have sat in front of him spending $40,000 a year to listen to this guy, and he's got to come back and say, oh yeah, I fucked all that up. I was wrong. That's why we don't just go back to it, because the way we came off of it is so twisted and so beneficial to those that profit from it, that it must be viciously attacked. And think about how many things are viciously attacked by scientists. I'm sure you've seen some very recently in the recent past few years. But once you see that pattern, you should see it everywhere. Anytime someone comes along in the world of science and says, hold on, I found something new, I think you guys are wrong. Instead of saying, oh shit, let's look at it, see if we can learn something together and prove or disprove this, they're immediately called a hack and they're attacked. We've seen this in, you know, anthropology. Science decides, hey, Clovis first, that's how people got here in North America. It's 10 to 14,000 years maximum, that's it. It's the oldest we found, so that's it. Then somebody finds something And they go, wait a minute, this is a human settlement, and carbon dating tells us this is 20,000 years old, and it's in the new world. So, okay, that old number must be wrong, or we're wrong about this. So let's... No, shut up! Shut up! Because academics, professors, researchers, scientists, they all have egos too. And the longer you've invested in something, the more you'll defend it even when you know you're wrong. Hey, man, wait at least till I'm dead. I can sell the rest of my textbooks and all, and then do whatever you want. That's how we got here. So what did we do before we got here? How did we feed ourselves before chemistry came to save us from everything? Well, number one, we used fire because we had to clear things, and we didn't have... See, and this is part of the problem. This is a big part of the problem. The solution that got the credit for the Green Revolution, for producing more food, to having higher yields, which we don't really have much higher yields than we used to per acre. Our higher yields are per person. And when I say per person, I don't mean eater, I mean producer. One farmer now produces way more than 10 farmers used to produce. But how did that happen? We say it's fertilizer, and it's herbicide, and it's all these chemical solutions. But the major driver of it was a different technological evolution. Mechanical engineering. Instead of having a whole group of guys with scythes cutting down the wheat field, we have one giant combine that per pass cuts 18 feet, some of them more than that. That's, and like, the chute's going, and it's being harvested dry, and the grain's going straight into a giant uke truck. Oh, look what the fertilizer did for our yields. No, dummy, that's what mechanical engineering did for your yields. So before we had that, when we had to clear an area, we burned it. Well, what do you get when you burn? You get charcoal. You get carbon. You enrich soil with carbon. Now, this can be done as like a slash and burn. And when it's done that way excessively, it actually destroys ecosystems. But people that depended on what they produced quickly figured out, hey, we shouldn't do this shit anymore. Not everywhere. Don't get me wrong. Prior to this, there are places where man destroyed ecosystems with agriculture. And primarily because they plowed and they monocropped. But overall, we did fairly well globally. We used cover crops. Cover crops are ancient. They go back thousands of years using cover crops. We'll talk a little bit about more of that in a second. And they used thyme. They used thyme. And what that was is that when they grew something somewhere and that land started to wane in production, they stopped using that plot. We call this crop rotation. And they moved to a different plot, and they farmed that one, and they moved back. And they allowed the land to recover by growing natural plants and fixing its own problems, right? They let the biology do the restoration instead of always hammering the same thing. And then primitive agriculture was highly polycultural, meaning that they didn't typically grow one thing. When places did grow one thing, like Egypt with wheat, relying on flooding from the Nile, they expanded the desert, even back then. So where we did things, if you want to look at the most sustainable things that man have ever done from an agricultural standpoint, you would look at what the real genesis of the so-called Three Sisters Garden is, which was done, but nowhere near to the level that people make it out to have been done in North America. This was more, well, North America, Mexico is part of North America, Mexico, and down into Central America, this was a system called middens, M-I-D-D-E-N-S, middens. And this is the original food forestry, and it was stands of maize, corn, but along with things like manioc and avocado and tons of other plantings, growing wild cioente, which is the wild predecessor to corn, along with it to strengthen the genetics of the corn, but moving the plots of corn. Again, these were called middens. You can learn about that if you want to. 1491 by Charles C. Mann, which is America before Columbus, goes deeply into that if you want a more academic explanation of them. But cover crops were used thousands of years ago in China and Asia. That's what we have documentation of. So when you hear somebody talk about cover crops and you think this is some newfangled hippie bullshit, no, this is the most ancient, sustainable, reproducible agricultural technology that we still have available to us today. About the only thing older than cover crops is probably irrigation. Figuring out if we put water here when it doesn't rain, the plants will live until it does rain. That's probably the only thing older than that. Just more recent history, a couple hundred plus years ago, there's letters between Washington and Jefferson and Washington and other contemporaries, Jefferson and other contemporaries, James Madison and other contemporaries. Those are founders of the United States, lamenting that colonists and then later Americans were failing to use cover crops in their agricultural processes and predicting the exact disaster we're looking at today. That was when everything was still biological. There was so much land here, and the land was so fertile, and so much of it was so flat, it was so available, that people started shortcutting even back then. And exactly what we're looking at, there's an entire treatise written by James Madison. He wrote more than just the Constitution, guys. That talks about all of these things that far ago. This isn't new. This isn't new. All right? And then the other thing is a large land plot. What is a large farm today? What is a large farm today? Not to you. To farmers. To people that really farm for a living. What's large? What's like, man, that old boy, he got himself a big old farm. It's not 100 acres. I mean, 100 acres is a big chunk of land. Don't get me wrong. You almost can't appreciate how big 100 acres is. Until you see it. But when we talk about big farms today, we're talking about multiple sections, right? Somebody's saying sections. Green Country Agroforestry is saying sections. We're talking about multiple sections. Dean Mullis says 3 to 5,000 acres. I'd say, yeah, most people say it's a big farm. But Food Forest Farm says 100,000 acres. And yeah, there's plenty of people out there that are farming 1,000 to 40,000 acres. And there's plenty of places we have 40,000 acres monocropped. So what's the problem with that beyond the obvious? From a standpoint of the permaculture principle of observation and interaction, if you are, you know, a landowner that has 10,000 acres, let's say, right? 10,000 acres. And you have a small amount of people working for you. You use a lot of mechanization and equipment and things like that. Then you're going to not how well are you going to pay attention to your soil? Like how well are you going to notice that things are wrong? And I need just a second, guys. How quickly are you going to ascertain that, for instance, there's less frogs on your property, with amphibians being one of the key indicator species that we've damaged the health of an ecosystem? You're not. You're not going to be intimately connected with your land with that large of a piece of property. Now, I'm not even saying that we can't use the type of things that I'm going to talk about today to farm land that large, because we can. We absolutely can. And we need some of that mechanical engineering from John Deere and others to go, and Kubota and all to go along with it. Like, we can farm thousands of acres, and we can do it right. What I'm saying is when you've made the change and the money's rolling in early on, 40s, 50s, 60s, where those inputs are cheap, you don't notice the problem because the money makes you not look in the volume of the land. What was a big farm 100 plus years ago? What is the magic number that people wanted, right? Where it's like, what was it? Blank and a mule. How many acres? 40. 40 acres. When we had 40-acre land plots, A man could make a living and raise a family on 40 acres. You cannot do that today. I am sorry. Now, you can run a two-acre market garden and make a living. But you know what I'm saying? When it comes to straight-up cash crop farming, you are not making a living on 40 acres. You certainly ain't going to make a living like men did at the time. Dude was the farmer, plus he had other entrepreneurial things, but he basically ran everything off of his 40-acre square. He had a family, 8, 10, 14 kids, sent some of them off to college. Mom didn't work. She volunteered at church, and he did all that with 40. You going to tell me anybody's going to do that with 40 acres today unless they go into something highly specialized? I mean, I can tell you, I know someone that's employing something like 25 full-time employees, and they're doing it on 5 acres, but they're growing organic roses in New York State. Okay, so that's not what I'm talking about. You understand what I'm saying. So we used to have farmers. A big farm would be 40 acres. A huge farm might be 4 40-acre blocks in a 160-acre section, right? Today, we have people doing thousands of acres and almost never looking at most of the land. So they don't observe and interact with it. They don't see the problem. And the problem's been accumulating over 100 years now. That's part of how we got to this. And a majority of people in the world just 100 years ago practiced some form of agriculture. 100 years ago, the number one occupation of people in America was farming. But even people that weren't farmers farmed or gardened or grew something. I grew up in the 80s and the 70s, and most of the people I knew in rural Pennsylvania had gardens and small farms. Most of the people that, like, my uncles and all worked with either had a garden. Many of them were actually small farmers, but the farm wasn't going to pay enough to make a living on anymore. But they had that 30, 40, 50 acres. And they grew some corn, and maybe they grew some, you know, some other stuff, and, you know, maybe they had some livestock and all. But most people were somewhere connected either directly or one level away from agricultural life, which meant what? A lot more eyes on the observation and interaction. But it was also a lot more people to go, wait a minute, this is wrong. This isn't right. This isn't the way things work. This food doesn't taste like it's supposed to, because they knew what it's supposed to taste like. Now you go 3-4 generations with farming being an industry that employs a minority of the population, and the majority of the population, as long as they get enough Federal Reserve space credits to buy their food with, and they get adapted to all these chemicals, all these non-food, food additives, they think everything's fine. They don't see the problem. They don't see a problem at all. They don't know there's a problem. You try to tell them there's a problem, and they want to talk to you about what? CO2. But they don't even know what a fucking carbon cycle is or how it works. They don't know that you can't have a complete carbon cycle without biologically active soil. It's not doable. Did you know that? The carbon cycle cannot exist when the majority of soil it's relying on is a carbon sink is below 1% organic matter. We have an of course we have excess CO2 in the atmosphere. We have an incomplete carbon cycle. I said this a couple weeks ago. We're supposed to have at least 2%. Ideally 5% organic matter in our soil. That'd be perfect. If you could order your soil from Walmart and they would deliver perfect soil, it would be 5% organic matter. By the way, it would be almost half empty space. About 50% oxygen and 25% oxygen, air, should say air, not oxygen, 25% air and 25% water in empty space between the aggregates and 5% organic matter. And we have farms that have 0.1% organic matter. 0.1%. How do we not fuck up the planet when we've destroyed the ability for the carbon cycle to be complete? You know what else you can't have? You can't have if you don't have healthy soil. Healthy soil has organic matter and it has living biology. You can have organic matter that's dead. You also have to have living things. You have to have bacteria and fungi and nematodes and arthropods and all kinds of little critters in your soil to create the aggregation and to create biogels and to glue the soil together so it can form aggregates, that's little pieces, many particles of soil stuck together so you can have the empty space. And without that, you know what you don't complete? The water cycle! We don't have a complete carbon cycle or water cycle on most of the planet today. Gee, what could go wrong? I want you to think about this. I would like the people in the live stream to see if you can answer this for me. If water doesn't infiltrate when it hits the ground, it can only do two other things. There's only two other potential things that it can do. What are those two other things? Water fails to infiltrate into the soil. What are the two other things that it therefore has to do one or the other of? Somebody says, wash it out to sea. I'll give you credit for that one, builder of castles. It runs off, right? Whether it washes out to sea or whatever, it runs off. That's one way. And the other thing is to evaporate. But if water is going to evaporate, what must it first do when it hits the soil and when it can't infiltrate? What is the other thing that it has to do? It does evaporate. Everybody's saying evaporate. But what happens before it evaporates? What happens before evaporation? If it does, it settles. That's a good answer, sort of, Dean. Evaporation, we're still saying there's the word I'm looking for. It pools. It ponds. It sits. It moves from the ridges to the valleys. And if it moves from the ridges to the valleys, it either runs down the valley or it finds a depression in a valley. And a valley can be something so subtle you can't see it. We're talking from macro, big, giant, obvious, down to very small. Everybody's seen it, haven't we? Haven't we driven past a farm that was just plowed? Should be just soaking water up, but the soil's got hard pan under it. And you either see this big swath where all the soil washed away, or you see a big mud puddle. Now, if the water is running across instead of going in and through the soil, or it's sitting on the surface and being evaporated away, how in the hell can you have a completed water cycle? Do you think streams are really supposed to come from water that washes over ground? No. If that's where streams came from, when you cut down all the timber on a mountainside, the stream wouldn't stop running, would it? What happens when you do that? When it rains, the water comes much faster, and it goes down, but you end up with most of the year you have a dry stream bed. Where do you think they came from? Do you think they were always that way? There's a diary I read one time, like a section of a diary. It was in another book. Can't remember the book now. Can't find it either, damn it. But it was a person who, for money, during Western settlement, was working in Montana. He was working in the timber industry. But the timbers they were cutting weren't for lumber to go back east. They were cutting trees to make mining timbers for silver mining. And in his diary he wrote, "As we cut the trees, I'm watching the streams dry up." So you don't have a complete water cycle. You don't have a complete carbon cycle. It's all being done through agriculture, which is supposedly green and going to save us all with the use of biocides, and we wonder why we have a problem. And here's the bigger problem. In spite of all the environmental damage, at least it's fed people. We are reaching the end of that rope. We are creating a false Malthusian trap. We are exceeding the capacity of the land to recover from our damage and therefore creating that self-fulfilling Malthusian prophecy. So even though I said it's never happened, we seem damned intent on making it happen. And since what everybody's worried about is making money, there's so much of a vested interest defending this nonsense that it's very difficult to move it. There's incredible social pressures. I encourage you to look up Ray Occhialetta and listen to some of his talks about how farmers who switch to no-till and cover cropping are literally socially attacked by neighboring farmers who don't understand what they're doing and think it's wrong because the guy that tells them to buy all the shit told them it was wrong and they trust him because him and his daddy and his granddaddy have been selling them their chemicals and their seed, etc., for three generations now. This is what we're stuck with. This is what we're trying to move against. And almost all agricultural systems in the past incorporated animals. If you get up to the point where man started plowing, but we didn't have the internal combustion engine, if you wanted to plow, how are you going to plow? You're going to go out there by yourself and push the plow? This actually happened in a few places, but it didn't take people long to figure out, hey, these big ox guys, right, if we feed them and we pet them and we chill them out, we can teach them to pull way more than we can. And by the very nature of using oxen in your, just as your plow muscle, you had animals incorporated in the system. And if you go to anywhere where subsistence agriculture is still practiced and doesn't fail, there's animals one way or another in the system. And even if we do not have what we think of as livestock, we don't have sheep and cows and pigs and all that stuff. If you have biologically active soil, you have the most biomass that anybody could ever have as livestock or animals in your system in the form of earthworms. The earthworms create what we call the drillosphere. The drillosphere is the channels in the soil. You think that's good for infiltration so that your water supply, your water cycle can complete? If you have worms living in your soil, what are they eating? They're eating microbes. They're not eating what you think they are. When you plant a cover crop in your garden and you cut it down or you pack it down or you crimp it down or whatever and it starts to slowly decompose, you think the worms are eating it? They're not. They're not. You know what's fun? Like, I grow earthworms, actually red wigglers, compost worms and earthworms, both, in some of my aquatic systems, my ebb and flow beds. And you take and throw something down, like a piece of burlap or like a big old wad of like string algae on top. And then when you lift that up, they're all under there because they can come up out of the leca, out of the media, and be in a nice, cool, wet environment in the dark. So you're like, I know, I'll feed them under there. So you throw a bunch of fish food down. You come out the next day and you open it up and there's all kinds of worms around. But they're really more over here where you fed them a couple days ago. And all that fish food or chicken feed or whatever you threw in there for them to eat is still there. What's that all about? 2 or 3 days go by and you pull it up and there's a billion of them under there, right? And all the food's mostly gone. What are they eating? They're eating, the food started to break down and decompose. The microbes moved in, started consuming the food, and the earthworms are eating the microbes and the waste product from the microbes. They're not really looking to eat the thing that you think of as food. Okay, so what does that mean? That means we have massive amounts of life in the soil, so we're incorporating the animal kingdom, even if we're not directly bringing in a chicken or a pig or a cow. And this was the way, as long as humans grew, until we developed shortcuts, cheats. And cheats almost always hurt you in the long run. Again, and now we have cheating being done on behalf of 8 billion people in the planet on trillions of acres of ground. Again, gee, what could possibly go wrong? So how do we take care of the soil? How do we reverse this? It's basic rules. Basic rules, and this will all be in my upcoming course on cover cropping, by the way. But number one is keep an armor on the soil at all times. Soil should not be bare, and if so, it should not be bare for long. Take a walk in the woods. What do you see? How much bare dirt do you see in the woods? Well, there's trees everywhere. Really? The trees are planted so close together, you can't see the dirt? That would be a wall of trees. No? No? Especially a mature forest. You go into a mature forest where maybe you have to get through a tangle and some brambles and shit right at the edge where it meets a field because all abundance is on the edge. But once you get into a forest, it's usually very park-like. It's very open because as the trees mature and canopy out, they kind of each take their area and they shade out competitors. And you can just walk through the forest even when there's no trails. It's a good way to get lost. Okay, do you see dirt? What do you see? Leaves. You see leaves. Massive amounts of sheet mulching done by nature. And what do you see when you pull the leaves back in a healthy forest? Do you see grainy, thin, compacted soil? You see beautifully aggregated, fluffy, gorgeous soil that's incredibly fungal dominant. Because that's how nature works. So if we're going to mimic nature, which is what we have to do to have a natural system that we have an active role in, we have to look at nature. This is crazy talk, right? This is insanity. You want a natural system, but you want to have an active role in it as a human that thinks beyond natural processes. You have to actually look at a natural process and mimic the natural process in a way that gives you the outcome you want. What does a redneck hippie duck farmer know about jack shit, right? That's just crazy talk. Biomimicry is what it's called. So we need to mimic nature, and nature keeps an armor in the soil unless something goes wrong. If there's a flash flood, areas get washed out. But unless it's an area that keeps getting mechanically disturbed, it grows back really fast. It grows back really fast until we completely disrupt things like the water cycle and the carbon cycle. It repairs itself very, very quickly. You know, if you go into the forest like I'm talking about, let's say it's toward the fall, you started having the acorns fall and everything. You might walk through the forest, and Jack said there'd be leaves everywhere, and all of a sudden you come to a place and there's these big, giant spaces about a foot, foot and a half in diameter, and you see bare dirt, and they're everywhere. What just happened? Probably turkeys came. The turkeys came, and they dug up the acorns, and they churned up the very thin top layer of the soil, and they ate the insects and stuff that were there. But what happens if you come back in 3 weeks? It's all covered back up. Then what happens in the spring before the trees leaf out? You go and you find things like miner's lettuce, right? Leeks, certain berry species and things like that. The shrubs leaf out and they produce in a very short cycle. And they cycle life and carbon into the soil before the trees come back. So if we're going to grow corn and we're going to grow wheat, and we're going to grow all, potato and all our cash crops that Big Ag grows that people eat, then we need to, in the down period, keep the soil covered and keep life in the soil. Not because I say so, not because I'm a genius, because the earth says so and the earth is designed by genius. However you think that happened, I think most of us can agree the design of the natural ecosystems of this planet are genius level. They are so far beyond our ability to comprehend, right? That's one of the reasons I believe in a creator. But even if you don't, if you believe it's through evolution, it is a system of perfection that man cannot even really understand. The best thing we can do is try to mimic it. So the next thing we want to do, we keep the soil armored. We keep it covered at all times. But we want living roots in the soil as frequently as possible. Now, if we're in a cold enough climate, no matter what we plant, it might all die. But usually we can plant something that doesn't necessarily die. It goes dormant and it starts to regrow in the spring, like a cereal rye or something like that. We want living root in the soil. Why? Because we have life in the soil and the life needs other life. So we want to keep a living root in the soil. Simple. It's not hard. Then we want to keep soil disturbance to a minimum, an absolute minimum. You can probably plow a farm every 4 to 5 years, once every 4 to 5 years, or plots once every 4 to 5 years, and you could probably build the hell out of organic soil. It still wouldn't be best. But land can handle that. The reparative components of nature are so powerful they can handle that. But a lot of people are plowing plots twice a year. We cannot handle that. You can't. Let me tell you a couple things that I think are really interesting. I learned both of these from Ray Aculoto. One, when the highway people want to put a new highway in, first thing they do is they clear everything off. They get rid of everything. But then they bring out the disc plow. And they disc the roadway. The same thing the farmer's using to supposedly decompact the soil, plowing and disking, is done by highway engineers. Why? Anybody know why? Anybody listen to one of his talks and hear why in the live stream? If so, go ahead and say it. So, They do this because there are an entire like family of bacteria that are known as R. strategist bacteria. R stands for reproductive or reproduction. And when the environment shifts to where they have the advantage, their population explodes and they feed on organic matter. And when you plow soil, the reason it works so well in the beginning is you switch on these bacteria, they multiply like crazy, and they start consuming the ever-living shit out of all organic matter. But if something's not done to restore that organic matter, eventually it's a battery that goes to empty without a recharge. And the bacteria themselves then, since they have nothing left to eat, they either go dormant or die. And so if I'm putting a roadway in, I don't want organic matter underneath it. What would you say? So somebody's building a road, just a little road, you know, through their own land, and you see them and they're out there with a backhoe or an excavator and they're digging out a trench where the road's going to go. And you go, wait, you're digging a hole. Oh, no, I'm going to put it all back. Okay, sure, I can see that maybe. And then they have a grabber on their excavator and they start grabbing pieces of wood, big trees. And you go, what are you doing? And they say, oh, I got all this timber that's low-value timber. I can't find anything to do with it. I need it out of the way. So I'm going to bury it and build my road on top of it. You'd say, if you understand anything about biology, you'd say, well, you're an idiot. Because that organic matter, that living material, now dead, is going to decompose and reduce in volume. And what's going to happen to your road? Going to fall in, it's going to get potholes, it's going to fall apart. Even if it's paved, eventually it will start cracking and falling apart. You want everything under a road base dead. So they use the plow to kill everything. We give it to a farmer and say this will make life. This is a misapplication of really amazing mechanical engineering. It's not that mechanical engineering's bad, it's what we're doing with it is bad. So we have to stop the tillage. Because if we do that, we burn up the organic matter, and therefore we do not have life in the soil. If there's not organic matter in the soil, and we don't use the restorative technology like a cover crop to take solar energy through photosynthesis in the carbon cycle and cycle carbon back into the soil, how can life live in the soil? First of all, it has nothing to eat. It has nothing to eat. But what is all life made from? As far as we know, I know Star Trek had like silicon life forms and shit, but have we found any life form that was not made of carbon yet? No. All life on the planet is built from carbon as its base building block. That's why we call it carbon-based life. So we call it that. All life we know of is carbon-based. If there isn't any carbon, how is the life form going to build itself? Where's it going to get the carbon? It gets it from the atmosphere, but how does the atmosphere put the carbon into the soil without the plant? You see how that works? You can't have a diverse soil web in your soil without carbon there, not only in their skeletons, in their bodies, etc. They make up part of the carbon, but they need base carbon to build themselves from. They need base carbon for their food. You can't have it without it. You can't have it without it. So we have to stop disking and tilling. And soil disturbance needs to go to absolute minimum. Doesn't mean you don't ever do it. There's a lot of places where good guys go in, Gabe Brown, Ray Aculeta, etc., and they might even use tillage for establishment, the first cycle, right? Or they have somebody that what they're trying to do might necessitate, again, tillage once every 3 or 4 years. And they'll go to minimal till instead of no-till. No-till's optimum, but we have to minimize it to the absolute minimum threshold that we need to get done whatever we need to do. Next, we need to stop using the cocktails of the sides, is what I call it. You know, I want you to think about this. Herbicide. Biocide. Right? Right? Pesticide. They'll end with the word side, C-I-D-E, or actually the suffix side, C-I-D-E. What does side mean? Not S-I-D-E, like, you know, your lateral part of your body. side, C-I-D-E. What is the meaning of that suffix? What does it mean? Humanocide. There you go. Builder, what does it mean? What is come on, I'll have another sip here while y'all get caught up on the lag and tell me what side means. No takers? Genocide. You're right there, Ernie. Yeah, genocide. Homocide. So what does side mean? When we add the suffix side, death. There, Carl got it. To kill. To homicide somebody is to unalive them, to kill them. So what are we going to do? We take cocktails of death. It's right in the name, and we put it on the food that we're going to eat and the land we claim we're stewarding. I'm just thinking maybe that's probably not the best idea. And the reason I call it the cocktail of sides is no matter how minimalist the initial intention is, once we begin to add the death, the side, then we kill part of the ecosystem and then things go out of balance. So what do? We go get another side. So we destroy through the application of something like an herbicide and killing all life prior to planting the thing that we want to grow, which is some sterile soybean or something with a monocrop. And when we apply that side, we wipe out all the beneficial fungi, which are the most important component of maximizing yields in production and agricultural systems. But beyond the fact that now we don't get that beneficial mycorrhizal fungi working with our plants, yeah, we also now have this maybe an explosion of fungal life that's malevolent fungal life. Right, so now we have bad fungi, fungal disease-causing fungi, that explode in our soils. We've advantaged them by throwing everything out of balance because what we think is malevolent is nature's attempt to rebalance. So now what do? I've got a fungal disease. I'm a farmer. I got 40,000 acres. My kid wants to go to Stanford. My daughter wants a Mercedes. I'm going to lose the farm, let alone buy the kids that shit. And I have a fungal problem. Who do I call? Do I call the fungal police? No, I call the same guy that I bought the herbicide from. And what does he say? Hey, Jack, no problem. We got it. Here's a fungicide. So now I spray now I've got the herbicide and the fungicide. Now I start having a problem. I'm using too much herbicide, and I'm not having enough time between the herbicide application and planting. And I call my guy, and he says, I don't sell seed, but I know a guy. I got another guy for you. And the guy comes in and goes, hey, what if you could, like, just plant your freaking soybean and spray the herbicide right on top of it, and it wouldn't kill it? And I go, you got to be shitting me, because this is 25 years ago. And the guy goes, nope, let me show you. And now I'm using more herbicide and more fungicide and a genetically modified plant that I'm putting the side on that I'm now giving to you to eat. See how we went wrong? So if we just don't start the biocide cocktails, we don't end up completing that into its logical conclusion, which is all the chemicals. Now, where do the chemicals come from? Do they come from Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, a leprechaun, helpful government officials, right? Except for NRCS, all of those things don't exist, right? Where do they come from? Come from the salespeople that sell them. How much do they want to sell you? All of it. Do you think they have a new one that they don't want you to add to your regime? And do you think they really want you to stop using one that they're already selling you? Or they just want to add more? The only time they want to replace A with B is when A goes to generic, right? It's no longer protected by patent, and the price of it goes through the floor without the patent protection. Then and only then do you self-cannibalize and come up with the better solution. So we have to stop the biocide cocktails, right? Then we have to use true diversity in both our cover and our organic crops. Since we want to emulate nature, right? And that doesn't mean we can't grow blocks of corn and blocks of potato and blocks of wheat. What it does mean is we can't grow thousands of acres of sterile individual blocks without ever rotating or thinking the rotation is corn, beans, beans, corn, beans, beans, corn. That's not diversity. That's two. That's not diversity. Tell me where you can go in nature ever, you know, as in Idiocracy, as seen in nature, right? Like, as seen in nature, where do you get a monocrop? Have you ever been anywhere in nature and been like, there's only one plant here? And the answer is you have not. Even if you think you have, you haven't. I guarantee you, if you take me to anybody's lawn that nobody's touched with True Green Chemlawn type shit, just a lawn, right? Unless you are chemically and mechanically making sure it's nothing but mamuya grass, right? A normal lawn in a square, I can probably by eye identify 3 to 4 species in any random square that you pick. And in other squares, I could probably identify more than that, let alone a forest or a meadow or a prairie. Go to a place where they monocrop. Go to a farm. Go in the bar ditch next to the monocrop where all the weeds are grown and tell me it's one weed. It's not one weed. So when we're putting in these systems, we need diversity for a whole plethora of reasons. But the most basic reason is biomimicry. We need to emulate nature. Even in our cover crops, we want roots that reach different depths, have different spreads, different root types, different symbiotic relationships. And the more diversity we have, without getting stupid, we're going diversity for the sake of diversity, that's the government. In the biological world, the more common sense diversity, which each diverse element having a reason for it to be there, not just solely for the sake of diversity, the more stable the ecosystem. See how simple that is? And I'm going to add to this to it. Every single plant on this planet has some toxic substance in it, some more than others. If you eat or you feed animals a single strain of something, you are accumulating more toxins in their system. Even if it's not enough to kill them or make them overtly ill, you're reducing their health across time. Where when they have a diversified intake of plant matter, which is what nature does. It's what nature does. I mean, white-tailed deer will gorge themselves on persimmons when they're dropping, but they only drop for a part of the year. They love white acorn when they're dropping, but they only drop for a part of the year. And even then, they're still eating other things. Nature doesn't monocrop, and very few living things eat a single thing, and specifically a single piece of plant matter. Because being dependent on a single source of food is a poor survival strategy in a world, right, where we know that we have survival of the fittest, whether people want to admit it or not. It's a very poor strategy, and a thinking being who chooses it is really stupid. Really stupid, and had been made stupid by an education system designed to make them that way. Next, you have to integrate animals into your system. We need to integrate animals into our system. People say, how do I terminate the cover crop? Well, graze it, fool. Well, if a farmer is growing hay, baling it up, destroying the land, because you're mining. When you hay, you take everything. So you're mining the land. And you ship the hay over here to a guy who's fucked his land up so much he doesn't have enough grass to feed his cow. And the cow eats it over here, shits over here. The cow's getting other feed and lots of salt, and the cow's making a toxic manure that when you compost it, it's like 5% salt by dry weight. Gee, that's just fucking wonderful. And then the farmer takes the salted manure that's been composted and puts it on his field trying to go organic and says organic doesn't work because he's in a system with no diversity, monocropping, destroyed soil, no soil life, and now he's salted his fucking farm. Yay! We're doing this shit, folks, on purpose. We are intentionally doing this, and we know that we're doing it. Do you think I'm some genius that discovered all this? you know, all on my own. I'm sitting around with microscopes and shit. How do you think I know this? How do you think I know this stuff? I know this stuff because it's out there if you'll just look for it. Which means everybody that wants to know knows. Everybody that wants to know knows. You either know and you ignore it because it's to your benefit, or you know something's wrong, but you don't look at it the same way the guy with the lump on his side doesn't want to go to the doctor, because then when the doctor says it's cancer, it really is, as though it isn't before the doctor says it. Yeah? This is, and yes, you should put questions in all caps, Andrew, and I haven't seen any yet, and I'm just monologuing today, so I may not see a lot of them, right? Put the word question in all caps, followed by your question. I'll try to answer a few today. We're later in the day, so I haven't been focused on that. All right. But we got to have animals in the system. But here's the idea. Why don't we plant a diverse cover crop? Let's say you were farming 1,600 acres. You had a pretty big farm. 400 acres is a pretty big plot. What if you were every 4 years, one of those acres was heavily in covers? Now, I think they should all be in covers at different times. You can cover and crop in the same year. But at least a quarter of the land at any given time is in cover. And instead of only farming corn and beans and potato or whatever, you also farm sheep or cattle. And you time your cover so that when you want them terminated, it's the time to graze the cattle. The cows come in. They eat the cover crop. That'll terminate the shit out of it, literally. Then they take the cover crop, the part above the ground. They grind it up. And they hold it at about 100 degrees Fahrenheit in a biologically intense, biologically active reactor called a three-ruminant stomach for about 24 to 48 hours, ferment and digest it partially, and then deposit it as a round, moist patty on the soil for you. This seems like a more efficient way to do this, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem more efficient than cutting hay, rolling it up in a bale, putting it on a truck, and shipping it from fucking Missouri to Texas? Oh, by the way, this shit works everywhere. There's people doing this in South Dakota, where they get less than 10 inches of rainfall a year. And there's people doing it in South Texas, where they get less than 10 inches of rainfall a year. And somebody now is going to tell me, I live in North Carolina and get 48 inches of rain, it won't work here. I'm done. I'm not even trying to explain how ridiculous that statement is. It's not different where you are. You might choose a different crop, a different timing, a different application rate, etc., but it works everywhere. If plants grow, then growing plants work. All right? It's not hard. It's not hard. I'm going to get Andrew's question started. I got three questions started there for now. So, this is the last part I want to finish up with. You need healthy soil for three things that we don't have right now. We have parts of them. But we have major disruptions to them at a global level. You have to have healthy soil for that complete carbon cycle. And there's people that think I'm some environmental, like I hate the environment or something, because I don't buy into all the hysteria around global warming. I want the carbon in the soil. Not because the planet might get too warm or too cold, but because the carbon belongs in the fucking soil. Right? I mean, where do you put your garbage? You put it in the garbage can. Do you put it in the garbage can because you believe in the garbage can God? Or do you put it in the garbage can because it's where the garbage is supposed to go, not on your floor? If it's organic garbage, I put it where? In the compost. Why? Because that's the place for it to go. I don't want the banana peel from my grandson's banana on my coffee table or outside on my fire pit table where I found it the other day. I don't want it there because it doesn't go there. The carbon belongs, not all of it, but much of it, way more of it's there, belongs in the soil. And without that, you cannot have a carbon cycle. And a carbon cycle is something that all life on this planet is dependent upon. So I think we should have one. So we need to do that. So we need healthy soil so we can have a complete carbon cycle. We need healthy soil to have a complete water cycle. What did I say? The water falls down as rain, lands on the ground, it can't infiltrate because the soil's not healthy, and therefore it becomes compacted. What happens now? There's only two things. It runs away, and it takes the soil with it, and it makes everything worse, or it finds a depression, and it ponds, and it evaporates. And then it makes, what happens, what happens in your own backyard? You have a bare spot, it gets compacted, it rains, and it rains so much the water builds up on it. Does it all of a sudden grow back? No. It gets more compacted, and then when it dries out, it cracks. And hopefully when it rains again, water actually gets in the cracks. And then the earth can begin to heal itself, right? It's not a good thing when either of those two things happen. You know what's even worse, though? Well, you know, I'm out here in West Texas. I need to grow me some cotton. That's a money crop out here. It don't rain enough. Well, if you manage your soil right, it actually rains plenty to grow cotton in West Texas. You would need very little to no irrigation. Because we've done it. Okay, hey, and I don't mean me personally. I mean, I can show you places doing it, and if they can do it, you can do it too. Right? Literally, I have people, my farm's different, and the next farm over is doing it. Like your fence is this magic demarcation point. Bill's works, Tom's doesn't, because Tom's on the wrong side of the fence. Damn the luck of where we put that fence. It's absolutely idiotic, right? But if we're irrigating, we have a circular, you know, you fly in a plane and you look down and you see green circles everywhere, right? That's an irrigation circle. We put a well in. Usually they hook something up like a windmill to it that pumps the well, and the water flowing through the irrigation arm causes it to move and it goes in a circle and irrigates the ground. But you have biologically dead soil. So you irrigate the piss out of it so enough will infiltrate to keep cotton plant alive. What happens to all of the water that doesn't infiltrate? Now, this is a pretty flat area we're talking about. So very little of it runs off, right? Pivot farm, that's what they're called. Food Forest Farms has got it. It's a pivot farm. Under that pivot arm, what ends up happening is the water pools. Well, now what does it do? It's the answer everybody gave to this question the first time. Instead of pooling, after it pools, then it evaporates. When you take water from a well, unlike water that falls as rain, it has absorbed and dissolved mineral salts. What happens to mineral salts that are suspended in water acting as a solvent when it evaporates? Right? What happens when you're outside working your ass off and you sweat your ass off and you're wearing a black shirt? What do you see on your shirt after it dries? What color is it? What's the residue look like? White. It's white. When we were stationed in Honduras back when I was in the Army, they would literally give us salt pills because of how much we sweated to make sure we were replacing the salts in our bloodstream. And at the end of the day, like, you take your shirt off and you could literally break salt off your T-shirt. We're doing that with the land. And it's not a huge amount of salt. It's fresh water. You could drink it, but it's a small amount of salt. How many years of irrigation do these farms have now? We're salting. We're salting the soil while we kill the life. We can't have that. We can't. Healthy soil necessary for a complete water cycle. Otherwise, we end up erosion, ponding, more compaction, incomplete water cycle. And last, and this is the most important thing, it should be the most important thing to all of us. Without healthy soil, you can't have a healthy population of plants, animals, fungi, humans, and all life on the planet. All life on the planet is either directly or indirectly dependent upon healthy soil. Gee, why are we all so sick? Why do we have chronic diseases running away? Sure, it doesn't help that we're extracting, you know, chemically derived industrial sugars in the form of high fructose corn syrup from corn that is not human food. Or industrial lubricants that we call seed oils, right? That's all bad. But in the end, the nutritional quality of our food is jack shit compared to what it should be. It really is. And it's because the soil's not healthy. And if you look at, like, in the history of the world, diseases and pandemics, there's literally correlations with specific soil deficiencies. There's a place, an area in China, I don't remember what it's called now, but it has traditionally had higher death rates of respiratory illnesses, like flus and shit, right? This was pre-COVID. But that area, like especially prior to globalization of the food supply, it had that going on, it's completely deficient in selenium. So the diet of anybody living there and living mostly on locally grown food is selenium deficiency. We don't even know what deficiencies we have. And I'm ignoring the fact that like 90% of your body, as far as it's not water, is bacteria and viruses. You're more bacteria and virus than you are human, including at the genetic level. And all of this is dependent on nutrient cycling, and all of that is dependent in the end on healthy soils. So this is why I say biology over chemistry. Chemistry is great for understanding this, but biology is the system by which it runs on. So we can understand the chemistry of how something like a soil organism is healthy or unhealthy. And when it produces waste, what's in that waste? And when a plant literally sucks up soil microbes like a vacuum cleaner and eats them, and we think this is all symbiotic because Elaine Ingham told us this, but I'm sorry, Elaine, it's not. Plants are predators. They're literally eating soil organisms. I mean, the first time I heard that was from Matt Powers, and it blew my mind. And unlike the academic, the first thing I did was come on the air and go, I was wrong. I was wrong. I just learned something new about this. I didn't worry about saying the wrong thing for 15 years because some PhD told me and I believed her. I said, no, I was wrong. The plants are killing the microbes. But it's okay because they reproduce their ass off. They don't live that long anyway. You know, they had a good life for the 37 seconds before they got eaten by the corn. It's okay. It's fine. That's the way it works. Nature, in the end, folks, nature knows what she is doing. Nature knows what she's doing, and nature is immovable in the end. In the long run, nature's immovable. I've seen trees grow on solid rock. I have a picture in one of my presentations of a slab of dead redwood with a black spruce growing straight out of that slab of dead redwood. And not beautifully located in the middle of the forest with all of the fungi going on. The tree died. A guy with a permit to remove the dead trees took the tree out of the forest, slabbed it, stacked it in slab, and set it off the ground so it wouldn't rot until he found a buyer. And while that slab was sitting there, a crack formed. A cone on the spruce tree released the seed. The seed fell into the crack. Small amounts of organic matter got in there and fungi. And the seed got enough water and it germinated. And if they leave it long enough, the new tree will eat the old tree. You can't do that. In other words, nature can kick your ass. In my permaculture principles course, I have a quote by David Holmgren that says, while nature is a great benevolent provider, it is also a great destroyer. You can't go to war with nature because you're going to war with a force that in the end will murder you. It will kill you if you go to war with it. It's not a fight we can win, nor one I have any wish to win. When you talk about working with nature, there's a reason. If you are so powerful that you can kill me by looking at me the wrong way, I probably want to cooperate with you. Nature can kill you with a dirty look. And anybody that's ever tested that, sooner or later found out that it wasn't worth testing. It really wasn't. Let's take a few questions here. I've got that one marked. This one marked. I'm looking to see if there's any more. Okay, this will be last call for questions. I've got six. If you don't see yours come up, you need to ask it again, and we'll get to you. We'll start out with Ernie. Ernie said, "What is a great way to lower pH in soil for blueberries?" You can amend with sulfur to lower pH. It depends, though. Like, what are you trying to lower? If you want to lower pH in a container, it's pretty easy. If you're trying to lower pH for something you're going to grow in ground and you have deep soils, you can do some of this, but in the end, we have gotten ourselves into this mindset that if I take a soil test and it says my soil pH is 7.1, then my soil pH is 7.1. Soil stratifies in layers, and as long as you're not like me, where you have like 4 inches of dirt on top of a rock, if you're doing healthy systems and you're building healthy systems, there'll be stratified layers of pH as well, and your blueberry will find the place to mainly do its work with its roots, and it'll be okay. Otherwise, you're looking at containers. If I do it here, blueberries look great until the heat stress comes, and it looks like somebody poured acid on them. They just burn up and die. They can't handle it. It's too alkaline. So you may live somewhere with so much alkalinity that you are chasing your tail doing this, and blueberry is not the in-ground crop for you. We can grow food anywhere, but we can't grow all food everywhere. Certain things do better in different situations. But if I was hell-bent on growing blueberries here, I would do them in containers or very deep, 2 foot deep like I put in raised beds. And I would do a custom soil mix that's geared toward acidity. Pine needles generally move you toward the acid realm. Some of the best blueberries we ever had, we planted at my house I lived in when I was a kid in Pennsylvania. And my dad, because he was cheap and he never bought anything he didn't have to buy, he would always, for mulch, just go into the pine stands and just take huge amounts of white pine needles and put them underneath, use that for mulch. It's quite allelopathic, which means it prevents other things from growing. But specifically, it's highly allelopathic, not as something that kills other plants, but prevents seed germination. That's why it's such a good mulch to keep weeds down. Well, we put the blueberries in, and then we mulched it like 6 inches deep in pine straw. And the second season, the blueberries on there were like grapes. So that'd be something you can try. Anyone Can Golf says, when are we going to catch and cook out at your Miyagi pond? I don't know. I do that for myself sometimes, but if I start inviting people, we can depopulate a 4,500-gallon pond pretty quick, can't we? So I don't know if I'll ever do that as a hangout. Maybe we'll do some live stream sometime while I do it. That'd be fun. Andrew says, what do you think of JDAM Korean organic farming methods? They claim they don't need to rotate, relies heavily on compost teas and fermented fertilizers. I think it works fine, but you're not doing JDAM and farming 40,000 acres of corn. JDAM systems are almost inevitably polyculture systems. And a lot of things that I've seen done with JDAM are like Chris Trump, and their primary crop that is, not really a monocrop, but it's a large stands of single species, is like macadamia nuts. When we move into the world of perennials, we're not tilling, we're not disturbing the soil, right? And most people that I know that are doing it and big fans of it online are small scale, like gardeners and whatever. And yeah, maybe they're doing their 4 rows or 8 rows of corn in the same spot every year, but the corn sitting next to tomatoes that are sitting next to peppers, you see what I'm saying? There's a polyculture environment in there. I'm actually a bigger fan of straight-up Korean natural farming than the JDAM that's an offshoot of it, because JDAM often uses things that I find to be toxic. I don't hate it. If I don't need to use a toxic thing, I would prefer not to use a toxic thing. So everything in the original Master Cho's stuff that's the Korean natural farming is something you could eat. Some of the stuff in JDAM would be quite toxic if you consumed it. Again, I don't hate it. It's not something I know a tremendous amount about. What are your thoughts of the purple tomato? I don't know what you mean. I have no idea what you mean by the purple tomato. Maybe you mean the one from Baker Creek that's actually GMO'd. I don't know. If you want to clarify that, Grow Big TV, and what purple tomato you mean, in what context, I will come back to you and answer it. Ashley says, my well water is very high in calcium. I learned from Matt Power's book that's not good for the garden, but people lime their soils here in the Ozarks. What's up with that? If you have highly acidic soil and you have basic water, alkaline water, it's probably a good buffer. if that's what you have. Now, what I would ask is, why do you have alkaline water, right? Because if you have a lot of calcium in your water, you probably do, and acidic soil. So you want to check that out first. But here's the thing about this. Your irrigation should be sufficient to keep your garden happy anyway. You have calcium, you have calcium. It is what it is. I love Matt. I learned a lot from him, but that's a very generalized overriding statement. It's bad where, when, and how, and with how much use. My water has got so much calcium in it. If I put it a squirt gun and squirt you in the eye, I could probably knock your eye out. It's incredibly hard water. I irrigate it with all the time, and I have fantastic results. But I also have a lot of life in my soil, and I have high infiltration into my soil. If you have poor infiltration, you're going to build up massive calcium deposits near the surface. That would also be bad. So it's not necessarily bad. If you live somewhere where people are liming their soil, then water with calcium in it is probably going to fill that role for you, and you won't have to. But I also can't answer that because, well, what is the pH of your water? What do you mean by high calcium? What does that number look like? Well, how many parts per million? How much irrigation are you using? Are you irrigating twice a week or twice a day? Like, all of those things change whether that's a good or a bad thing. And what are your results like? What are your results like? Like, if your garden's doing fantastic, I wouldn't worry about what anybody's book says. Mine, Matt's, anybody's. It wouldn't matter. Builder Castles says, comment on raised beds. It helps out the soil that is there, but does it keep the healing from getting out? I don't understand that question at all. I don't understand what the hell you're asking, dude. So if you can restate that, I will try to come back to it for you. I see here's a question. Nurse Wang, why would whey from making yogurt be useful in lowering the pH for blueberries? Probably not. It's not going to be enough to have a true impact on the soil's pH. It may have a short-term effect, but it's an incredibly valuable soil amendment, because it's lactic acid bacteria, and it will outcompete a lot of pathogens in your soil, and it's definitely something worth using. It's also very useful in aquatic systems and very useful for treating injuries on things like fish, where they kind of go at each other in the face and they get these white funguses and stuff. It's really good for that as well. Grow Big TV says, yes, the GMO purple tomato from Norfolk, and most likely the Baker's Creek tomato. Yes, there is a tomato called Purple Galaxy. I've already covered this. That's why I didn't want to do it again if you weren't asking about that. Called Purple Galaxy. They sourced it from a breeder in Europe who wasn't the breeder of it, who was breeder of other seeds, and they had dealt with in the past. And the place in Europe where this person is, GMO seeds are illegal. So Baker Creek believed that when the guy said it's not GMO, it wouldn't be. Turned out it was GMO. In the end, other than the fact that I hate that everything's turning into this, I don't really care. I'm not that concerned about a particular plant being genetically modified. I care mostly about what it's being genetically modified to do. So when we genetically modify a grain so that it can be grown in more saline soils, what we're saying is it's okay to salt the soil. That's a problem. When we're genetically modifying a bean so we can spray it with glyphosate, we're saying it's okay to spray a herbicide on a plant that a human being is going to later consume and eat, and it will be concentrated, especially if it's like soybean oil. So those are my bigger problems. I'm not that worried about it. I wouldn't select that variety now that I know that, but my ass is not in a wad about it. Backcountry Biomass, trying to add native species grassland to a section of my property. Can I plant the plants and seed with current normal grass weeds that are there, or should I till and start over? What you probably should do if you want to increase native grasses and things in your property is small amount of overseeding at opportune times, especially when minimal disturbances occurred, like tractoring chickens and things like that. No, you shouldn't till. No, you shouldn't till. If you're, and it depends, like that is like a consulting level question on the macro. like, what are you doing? Are you grazing? Because if you're doing proper grazing, you will end up in a mixed ecology perennial-based system in time. There are literally millions of seeds per acre sitting in your ground right now from native species waiting for the right germination trigger. So it doesn't hurt to bring in seed, but you don't need to. Alan Savory has grazing projects where he's brought in cattle. They were grazing on like woody scrub. Nobody could find a blade of grass. The ground was bare. And 5 years later, at the end of the rainy season, there's grass everywhere, and nobody ever put a single seed down. So I don't take a purist approach in many things, but I'm going to tell you that you don't need a ton of seed to convert these pastures. You really don't. I got one more here from Builder of Castles. In-ground beds start to aid the grounds around the gardens. Raised beds keep it in, maybe. You're worrying too much. I don't know what your biggest concern about that is. Where we intensively manage ground, it will be healthier than the ground around it. It will spread over time. Your raised bed makes ground contact somewhere, right? So unless it's a pot, unless it's enclosed, the biology will do what biology does and it will spread. But it's irrelevant to anything that you need to concern yourself with, in my opinion, unless you were using like dangerous chemicals and shit, and then you would worry about leaching. Life leaching is not bad. That's spreading life. It's called multiplying. It's biology. It's the way things work. So I will look at that one more time. If there's anything, let me know. Matthew, I saw you say that earlier, and I wonder if this is what you're talking about. You said ChatGPT says that book is likely Call of the Wild by Jack London. It is possible, and I've certainly read that book. Jack London is one of my favorite classic authors of all time, but I don't think so. I think this was actually more of like a fact-based history treatise of some kind where I read this. But that's possible, so thank you for that. Anyway, with that, let me go ahead and wrap things up. Let me remind you, if you like the work that we do here and you want to support us, one of the ways you can do that is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day fits right in with our discussion, and it is the overlap of like biology and chemistry, because I'm sure some chemist was involved in creating this, but it's a biological solution. This is Dynomyco Premium Mycorrhizal Fungal Inoculant. If you want to do the best thing in the world you can for your garden this year that will work quickly and is something you can actually buy and just start using, a good fungal inoculant product is the way to go. I put this stuff in every single plant that I start from seed, like in a pot before it goes out. I just put a pinch in. I don't do like the whole tablespoon or whatever the bag says, because I'm not growing cannabis, and cost does matter, and biology grows, right? So I put, and I mean, when I start flowers that get interplanted, like marigolds and stuff, this stuff is in there, and I'm building up the mycorrhizal fungi in the garden, plus the biological compost. All of it together works great, but you will see an immediate benefit from this. When your seeds germinate, the first association they're seeking is not NPK or manganese or calcium or anything else. The first association they're seeking, in other words, what do I want to partner with, is mycorrhizal fungi. It is a keystone thing for plant life. And once that mycorrhizal fungi and those roots get together, that's when the mycorrhizal fungi actually starts to live and grow. Otherwise, it's an inert spore. And it actually attaches to the roots of the plant, and it becomes a symbiont with the plant. And it effectively makes the plant's roots much larger than they are, where they can reach further for moisture and nutrient, and they have the symbiotic exchange with each other. This stuff looks expensive until you start doing the math on it. It is not. It will add about 2 cents to 4 cents of cost at a pinch a plant. And that's all you need, especially if you're starting your own seeds. This is one of the best things you can do for your garden. Here's another great thing you can do for your garden. Learn how to make really awesome compost. Learn how to make the bioreactor compost that I teach people how to make. The course is at homefoodsystems.com. It's $40. It is a great investment in your future. If you're an MSB member, you get $5 off. And these two things together are phenomenal in what they do. They fit perfectly with everything that we talked about today. So definitely consider those. And again, I appreciate everybody that's been with me today. I'm looking to see if we have any last questions that came in. Let's see. One more, and I'm going to go because it's late in the day. Shindaria says, do you have an opinion one way or another on biodynamics? I believe that biodynamics has very scientific reasons for why it works, that everything I've ever looked at in it and said, can I find a scientific reason for this to work? I can. It, however, also has a lot of hokum and hippy-dippy bullshit in it. But I understand why. Here's an example. One of the things in biodynamics is you take, you know, some soil and stuff like that, and you put it in a horn, like a bull's horn or a cow's horn or something like that, and you stick it in there and you close it up and you bury it in the ground. And I don't remember when, but it's like, you know, the fall equinox, let's say. And then, you know, when the moon's right and the spring equinox is either there or so, like, and you dig it up and then you apply it to your field. Okay, what you've done is you've taken the biology that we spent all day talking about it and you put it in a little protected place and you buried it deep enough that it never got as cold as the surface soil. And then you've reapplied it and you've seeded the biology and you've sped up the explosion of biological life in spring, and therefore you're going to get better results. You got that? Right? But when you listen to the explanation, there's a lot of bullshit in it, right? The spirit of the field or whatever. It comes from a time when a lot of the stuff that we're talking about at a scientific level today, the results were understood, but the cause was not. So I don't fault the people who developed it, but let's not mislead ourselves to what's going on there. You make compost, you make a compost extract, and you spray your field with it. You've done the same thing. We just happen to have a more scientific explanation for why it works. So I'm not shitting on anybody for doing biodynamics. I'm just going to say that some of the cause, as explained, related to the effect observed, there's a breakdown. There's a breakdown. It's like the thing, you know, if you actually are old enough that you learn the actual fucking scientific method in grade school, what's the classic experiment? They thought meat made maggots. So you have rotten meat and maggots show up in it, but to put the meat in the jar and put the piece of cloth over it so air could flow back and forth, but the fly couldn't get on the meat. You put two pieces of meat, one in the jar with the lid, the cloth lid, and one in the jar without the cloth lid. And 2 weeks later, one is stinking nasty and covered in maggots, and one is just stinking and nasty. Well, that experimental component was lacking as this was popularized, in my opinion. So, it's not bad. It does work. It's just, like a lot of things that seem spiritual or whatever, there is a scientific explanation for why. And unlike a lot of things like that, we actually know what those answers are. So there you go. Hopefully that doesn't piss anybody off, because I know different methods have their adherents and they get really defensive and angry and whatever. Anyway, guys, it is, well, wow, it is almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's what happens when you get delayed till a 2 o'clock start. Hope you guys enjoyed today's show. I'll catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? Said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.